Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we learn about America's largest export and most plentiful product, trash, garbage. Columbia University's BioCycle researchers estimate that each day Americans produce 7.1 pounds of trash per person. That's 102 tons of garbage in a lifetime. My guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and author Edward Humes. His investigation into how we dispose of, recycle, reuse, and literally waste our trash is titled Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash, and it's out in a new softcover edition. We learn in it that Americans spend more on waste management than fire protection, parks, libraries, or school books, that our trash could produce more energy through methane gas than all current renewable energy sources combined, how individuals are profiting from our garbage, from Chinese billionaires shipping waste paper back to China to artists who turn dumps into supply stores. Edward Humes received a Pulitzer Prize for his newspaper coverage of the military. He's written for publications such as the New York Times, Los Angeles Magazine, and the Los Angeles Times, and is the author of 11 other nonfiction books. Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash, is out in paperback from Avery this month. Edward Humes, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Your book, Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash, now is out in a new paperback edition. Give us a sense of why you decided to write about garbage. I mean, it's such a huge subject, and we create so much of it here in the United States.
Well, a couple reasons. One is people, it turns out, are fascinated by this utterly commonplace thing because we don't really know what our trash looks like, what's in it, and what happens to it, even though it's such a omnipresent part of our lives. And the other thing is if you dig down, pardon the pun, into our trash, you find out that waste is really at the core of a lot of our big problems, whether you're looking at energy, our economy, the way we live every day. Waste has really burrowed into every corner of our daily lives in ways that are unexpected.
You know, I was just remarking with a friend not too long ago, it was only in the last generation where the little fix-it appliance shops all finally just sort of went out of business, at least in this part of the country. And to me, that's, you know, whether it's a TV repair shop or you know, the small appliance fix-it, that was the mentality of our country for a long time, was you bought an appliance, if it broke, you fix it. Now it's you throw it out and buy a new one.
Well, that is the perfect example of this shift, because if you think about it, we are living in a way that no other people in history has ever lived, with this single-use, disposable culture and economy that we have. And you're right, that's a great signpost, the TV repair shop, and before that, the radio repair shop. And why did they exist? It wasn't just because we were more thrifty, although we were. It was because the products that we had were designed to be repaired or to be upgraded. Look at the first computers. They were designed to be boxes that you could plug in improved components into over time so that you could have a better computer without actually getting a new computer. We don't do that no more. We value different design criteria, I suppose, and either that or it's become cheaper to manufacture things very inexpensively and then toss them aside and replace them. And, I mean, go try and fix your VCR. Can you get it fixed for $39 if you even have a VCR anymore? Your DVD player, I guess, maybe we should think about. Do you fix it or do you get a new one? Turns out most people will just go out and get a new one.
In fact, if you actually try to get something repaired, you're usually told, well, it'll be more expensive to repair than to buy a new one. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Well, one of the things you discovered in investigating garbology was the fact that there are people who are sort of taking our waste and making, in some cases, an incredibly great living at that. One would be Zhang Yin, the first woman billionaire in China. She built her fortune on taking our waste paper and basically sending it to China.
Absolutely. Well, she saw that our, you know, it's an old philosophy, but somebody's trash is always somebody else's treasure. And she created an entire business out of exporting our scrap paper to China, which was just then in the 1990s ramping up as a supplier to major consumer markets like the U.S., and they needed cardboard, and they needed paper, and they needed packaging, and they had already deforested their own domestic supplies to a large extent, and Shen was there to fill the void. Fast forward to today, and here's one of the big surprises about waste. Our number one export in terms of volume, in terms of cargo containers, is mostly our trash, our scrap paper and our scrap metal. That's our biggest product. And she's a big part of that.
Basically, the container ships are coming over with finished products to the United States. They were going back empty. And she basically said, wow, I could probably fill that space pretty cheaply because they're going back empty.
It was going back empty, so if she could pay a pittance to ship her scrap back, and it was still a positive for the shipping company. So she parlayed that into quite a successful business. And it's so successful that she also built factories in China so that she now is making the products out of that scrap and then sending them back to us, making dollars for pennies. And it's a great business model for China, but in a very real way, we have turned ourselves, the United States, into China's trash compactor.
Mm. And in many ways, that's really bad because it's not just paper and scrap metal. A lot of times it's computer components, televisions. When we had the big switchover from analog to digital, probably most of those recycled televisions went to China and they were salvaged for, component parts. And from what I understand, really creating an environmental nightmare in a lot of these places where they were stockpiled because you had all these heavy metals. And that's not a good situation otherwise. And there's a lot of people who look at that ethically as, we're basically moving our trash problems to other countries.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and if you look at the switch from cathode ray tube televisions and computer screens to the current predominant LCD technology, there is no longer any place in the U.S. to even dispose of an old cathode ray tube, a big bulky and highly toxic center of the classic old-style television set. And so those all are, in fact, shipped to places like China and other developing nations that then have to deal with our waste. And there's still millions upon millions of those types of televisions and monitors in the U.S. So we have just dusted our hands off and said, our waste is somebody else's problem in that case. And it's incredibly expensive and wasteful to ship our trash 12,000 miles because we don't feel like dealing with it. I mean, think about that. It's insane. Waste is so embedded. It was really a wake-up call for me to research this subject and to see how it has become the invisible part of our daily lives in every crevice. You look at how we use energy. We make epic amounts of energy in this country, and this isn't quite trash, but it's part of the larger picture of waste. We waste more than we use of the energy that we make because our buildings bleed energy, our waste disposal systems for both solid waste and sewage and so forth are incredibly wasteful users of energy. And we don't even see it anymore. We say, we have an energy crisis, but we don't think about the simplest way of attacking that, which is to try and rein in what we throw away every day. And it's a mindset that is not so easily changed because we're so good at making that waste disappear as if by magic, so we don't see it.
Give us a sense of how much waste we create. I think I read the statistic, 102 tons of garbage in a lifetime, about 7 pounds a day of trash that the average American makes.
Yes, it's so big that it's kind of hard to get your head around. So I've tried to think of different ways to make that visual for people. So if you take the trash that the typical American household makes for a year and just piled it on your front lawn every day or every week instead of having it carted away, what would that look like? Well, after a year, for every person in your household, there would be a pile of trash that weighs 1.3 tons for every person in your house. Now you begin to picture that. And how does that compare to other people in other times? Well, we're making per person in America twice as much trash as we did in 1960. What happened since 1960 that we are twice as wasteful as we used to be? Is it because we're more prosperous? Is it because we're, as a people, much happier because we have a lot more stuff? What's going on there? And if you look at that, you find out the biggest difference is packaging and containers is the single largest component of our waste that has grown, and plastics. Disposable, one-use, instant trash.
Right.
And that has been an epic growth.
Just trying to buy a product, and when you have the little shrink-wrap plastic on there, the hard plastic, it's like you're spending as much energy getting into that package as anything. And, of course, it goes right in.
Too, yeah.
Yeah, it gets right into landfills. And, when you look at the composition of our trash, Even today, with all the recycling efforts, a majority of the trash that goes to solid waste landfills is absolutely recyclable.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we recycle about a fourth of the recyclable trash that we throw away, and the rest goes to landfills. So figure about 25% recycling, 69% of it goes to landfills, and a small percentage goes to things like waste energy and composting and uses. And if you compare that to other countries, look at a place like Austria. 1% of their waste goes to landfills, less than 1%. They recycle three times as the proportion as we do, and they make energy out of the rest. If you look at the average Japanese citizen, makes about a third of the trash per individual that we do. Denmark makes half the trash per individual. And it makes sense to look at what other places are doing. It's hard for Americans to admit that other countries do some things better, but trash is one of the things we could really learn things from other countries that have really studied this a little more.
In our own community here in Tulsa, we were about 6 months into a new trash system, and our trash policies are sort of slow. I mean, a lot of other places have come to this level, but we finally have a fairly effective recycling program. There's still a lot of things they don't take, and you have to make a special effort to. But I was struck by how, when we actually, in our household, really started looking at what can be recycled, you know, that means that all the cardboard packaging, all the plastics, you know, the various number of plastics, our solid waste trash really decreased an amazing amount.
It's amazing how just a little switch in the kinds of incentives we have for people and businesses to behave in a certain way can have. You know, most communities in America, if you roll, however much trash you roll to the curb, you'll basically pay the same thing a month, whether it's to a municipal agency or to a private trash collector. It varies. But the model in 75% of the communities is the same. You know, whatever you put in your trash, that's what you pay your monthly flat fee for. But a minority of communities have something called pay-as-you-throw. And what that means is if you make less trash that has to go to landfill, if you have a smaller trash can than other people that they pick up every week, and you put more stuff in recycling, you get a lower bill. So the actual people who are costing the system less pay less. It's a much fairer system. But by doing that, you're also encouraging people to first recycle and second be less wasteful. So it's a really good thing. Businesses particularly like it because they can cut an expense simply by changing some of their daily trash making habits. So there's very simple things you can do. The reverse of that is junk mail. Here we have an incentive where we subsidize the creators of junk mail. I wonder how many of your listeners enjoy getting junk mail. There was last year 85 billion pieces of junk mail weighing 4 million tons. And because it's in the recycling lingo, it's called composite materials. It mixes paper and plastic and those little cellophane windows on envelopes and so forth. Most of it doesn't get recycled. Most of it ends up in landfill. 1% of our landfill trash in America is junk mail. No other country pays people, subsidizes the creation of waste like that that nobody even wants, and then puts on the recipients of it the added cost of having to deal with it because it's coming out of your trash bill to deal with that waste. So it's a crazy incentive to be wasteful, and we have a lot of that kind of thing going on here.
My guest today is Edward Humes, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and author. His book, Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash, has just now come out in a softcover edition, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things you did is, you know, you report on the Pacific Garbage Patch. This is this huge area of the Pacific where the circulation of the oceans go around and all the trash collects in this giant patch. You went out to Puente Hills, which is this huge landfill in Southern California. You interviewed Big Mike Spicer, who runs one of the big, huge trash-moving sort of bulldozer machines out in the Puente Hills landfill. Just says it's giving off more greenhouse gas than it's just incredibly wasteful, this huge landfill. But, of course, it's necessary because Southern California produces so much trash.
Yeah, well, this is, I call it Garbage Mountain because it is literally a mountain that's been under construction since the 1950s. And basically it's this area in the middle of Los Angeles County, a highly urban area now, although it was, when they first started putting trash there, it was like a dairy farm. And it would, if you could see the geography in the 1950s, you would see three peaks, the Puente Hills, one of which was so high that the military stationed a Nike missile installation at the top to protect the Los Angeles basin from Russian bomber attacks in the 1950s. It was a high point. Well, in the years that have ensued, the high point is now a plateau. The valley in between those three peaks has been completely filled with trash. You could put a baseball stadium and its parking lot on top of this plateau of trash now. It's so immense, and when you stand atop it, you are standing atop 500 feet straight down of waste. If it were a structure, it would be one of the 12 tallest structures in Los Angeles. think about that. And it is now a geographic feature. And although this is a particularly prominent one, we build variations of this all over the country to deal with our trash.
You know, it wasn't too long ago that you were seeing a whole host of stories about how we were running out of landfill space. But your book seems to lead me to believe that we still have a lot of space for landfills in our major metropolitan area. What changed?
Nothing really changed. What was happening was that the landfills we had were filling up.
So we created new ones.
Well, and that's a problem because, you know, nobody wants a landfill in their backyard. And it used to be a lot easier to just sort of proceed with these things. Dumps weren't highly regulated. There was a lot of, you know, there was many thousands more of them. But now they've become bigger and higher tech. And places like Puente Hills, actually, because waste, as it decays, emits so much methane, so much greenhouse gas emissions, some places try to capture it. And Garbage Mountain in L.A. is so big that it captures enough methane and generates electricity with it to power 50,000 homes. That's how much comes off these large scale.
And are they actually capturing the gas and burning it?
Yes, it's amazing to see how that's what they take these giant PVC pipes, you know, the kind you put your, you know, water sprinklers under your lawn with, only much, you know, you could practically get inside these things, and they're perforated, and they bury them inside the landfills, you know, hundreds of feet down in some cases, and put a negative air pressure inside it, and it draws in the methane. It's really quite clever. The engineers at Puente Hills figured out how to do this because landfills shift and settle over time as the trash compacts and as it decays, and these pipes would always break, and they figured out how to sort of fit them together loosely. They slide them in like sleeves into one another without attaching them so they can bend up and down and stay in place for years. And they capture maybe 80-85% of the methane that this dump generates, and it's enough to power 50,000 homes. So.
And you also tell about the old landfill out in Palos Verdes, out on the coast, and you said that even though it's been converted to parkland, there's still a sanitation staff. There are people monitoring the landfill that exists underneath this park, and they're still burning methane from that, too.
25 years after the last piece of trash went in there, it is still pumping out methane. So, you know, trash, when we dispose of it in this way, it doesn't really go away, and the environmental consequences remain. So, and many of these facilities don't capture their methane, and they try and flare it off. They burn it. They do other strategies to keep the emissions down. But EPA figures that our waste disposal is one of the most significant greenhouse gas sources around.
Now, you also talked to David Steiner, who's the CEO of a waste management thing. He loves landfills, but already his business is sort of starting to shift and say, how can we make money off this waste, not just from collecting the waste, but actually using the waste? This sounds like a really interesting philosophical shift.
Well, it is, because there's a growing recognition, and I have to say that, you know, in the 60s and 70s, we tended to view the businesses such as waste disposal as the environmental outlaws almost in the country, and they were a source of the big problems. And now they're kind of leading the pack, leading the thinking in a lot of ways on sustainability and what can we do to make waste management incorporated into materials management incorporated, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about, as Steiner says, the CEO of Waste Management, the biggest waste company in the world, says, I've got billions of dollars of value locked inside these landfills. Can we find a technology? Can we find a technique to recover some of that value and make a business out of it? So that's It's not altruism at work there. It's looking for a new business model, because look at all the cities and businesses that have said, we want zero waste to be our new strategy, because that makes economic as well as environmental sense. And, you know, you have communities like San Francisco that say by 2020 they will be zero waste. Well, what's a landfill company to do when there's no more stuff to put in their landfill? They need a new business model. And now, wow, suddenly you have a market incentive to figure out what to do with trash other than buried in the ground. So it's not that we're running out of space for landfills, because America is blessed with lots of space. And that's one of the reasons maybe we're behind places like Japan and Austria that don't have so much space to bury trash and have already had to grapple with this. Now we're trying to figure out better ways that make economic sense to deal with our waste.
And one of the big costs, we haven't talked about the cost, but I mean, we spend more on waste than we do on a lot of things that we probably value a lot more in our society. But I want to talk about the trash trackers. You had these MIT researchers who were planting electronics on pieces of trash, and we're taking our trash all over the country, aren't we?
Unintentionally, yes. Well, that's fascinating. I mean, they put these little, basically, it's kind of the innards of little cell phones, these computer boards that they modified to send out signals and attached it to old sneakers, coffee cups, you name it, to see where the trash went. Because businesses for many years have tracked their supply chain to see how, you know, Walmart is famous for this, of tracking every tube of toothpaste from China to the shelf in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And they know exactly where it is, when it's going to get there, and how many they got. Supply chain management is a science. Removal chain, as the MIT engineers call it, we know it's opaque. We know nothing about it. So they decided they were going to, you know, sort of do what Walmart does with its toothpaste and see where things go at the end of their useful lives. And it was... Sometimes they went right where we expected them to go, to the nearest landfill, and other times, you know, one of the great examples was a printer cartridge, an empty printer cartridge that was recyclable, was brought to a recycling station. And this printer cartridge that was supposed to be reclaimed in order to be more environmentally responsible traversed the country twice back and forth on this crazy transcontinental voyage before it finally ended up somewhere that it could actually recycle it. By that time, it had such an enormous carbon footprint attached to it that it would have been better off just burying it in the landfill 10 times over. And that was happening over and over, the meanderings and illogical directions that our trash takes, where it just sat around and didn't go anywhere, or was hauled offshore to be dumped illegally. It was very sobering that we have not attended to the end of life of our things the way we have done to their creation.
My guest today is Edward Humes. His book is titled Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. It's published by Avery. And he examines just about every aspect of how we have our trash collected, how it's disposed of, how people are making money off of it. And one of the things you mentioned earlier was, you know, how some communities are trying to go to zero net waste. In your afterword for the new edition, you look at this growing trend for communities to ban plastic bags. You use the example of Los Angeles doing that. And even though this only makes a half of 1% of our trash, is this a growing trend to start tackling these little small, you know, certainly plastic bags are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. But is this a new trend to sort of tackle this one product at a time?
It is, and plastic grocery bags are a great example, because we give them away for free, and people, you know, throw them out. They can't be recycled very easily, and so rarely are. Technically, they're 100% recyclable, but it doesn't really happen. And about 95% of them end up in landfills or end up blown away and find their way into the waterways and are part of the ocean plastic pollution problem that you mentioned earlier with the garbage bag. So they're a big problem, and they're an incredibly, you know, there's no other way to put it. It's a stupid product. Why just create this item that's designed to be thrown away when you could have a more reusable product? And the question is, how do you get that people to change their behavior and make that switch? And what places like Los Angeles have done, and many other communities now are looking at this or have actually done it, is put a small fee on disposable bags and say, look, we want you to pay a nickel or a dime every time you use one of these bags. And in the case of California, it's not a tax. Actually, the retailers keep that money. They're just told that they have to collect it for the to cover the disposal costs of the bags. Well, what do people do when they suddenly have to pay a dime for something that was always free to them? It irritates them. They don't like it. And what Los Angeles has seen is in the space of a year of having this ban in place, the use of disposable bags, whether paper or plastic, is down 75%. People bring their own bags, and it doesn't have to be something you buy. It could be a paper bag that you or a plastic bag that you previously got and are just reusing now, although a lot of people have more permanent-type shopping bags. Other countries have done this. It's very successful. The plastic bag companies don't like it, but look, the paper bag companies didn't like it when the plastic bag companies displaced them. And now you have companies that are making reusable bags that can be easily cleaned and are sanitary and durable, and that's a new business. So, you know, there's always winners or losers. In this case, we're making creating an incentive to eliminate a wasteful disposable product in favor of a reusable, less wasteful product. It's good all around. Now, I want to compare that to what Starbucks recently announced. They announced this program where they're going to have a reusable Starbucks cup that if you pay a dollar for as a customer, you get to keep and use over and over again, and if you use it, you get your coffee cheaper. I predict that will be a failure. It's a great thing, but nobody's going to do it in any significant numbers. If you want it to work, you give away that reusable cup, and you charge everybody a nickel for the paper cup, and then you will see mass adoption of the reusable model. Why? Because that's just the way our psychology as consumers work. So if it is in our power to push our entire society towards the reusable rather than the disposable, and that's going to happen sooner or later because we're going to run out of stuff to dispose of.
And I think the next one will be the single-use water bottle, too. You know, the plastic water bottle. I think that's already starting to happen. I know national parks have banned them in some of the Western national parks. You have to basically use a reusable water bottle.
Yeah, and there was a big fight over that, too. Yeah. But American consumers spend somewhere between $11 billion and $14 billion a year on bottled water, you know, and we're paying more per ounce for that water in the bottle than we pay for gasoline. whereas if you got it out of your tap, and most communities in America are blessed with very fine tap water, you know, it's a fraction of a cent for that bottle of water. So I don't know what's going on, but it is one of the most wasteful products ever conceived of. Not just in terms of the environmental impact, but in money. I mean, that's billions of dollars we could use for something we really needed, as opposed to something we can get virtually free out of our taps.
Well, it's a really fascinating look at our garbage. Edward Humes, thanks very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Edward Humes is the author of Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. It's out in a new softcover edition from Avery Books. By the way, we spoke with City of Tulsa waste officials, and since the new waste collection system went into effect late last year, solid waste going to landfills in the City of Tulsa has dropped by 20%. And recyclables are up to 70 tons per day. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.